Okay, everyone, it's meeting time. Hi, everyone. Hi. Hello. Good afternoon. My name is Carissa, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. I would like to welcome you to the Staying Sober During Life Changes workshop. Let us open with a 30-second moment of silence. Let us open with a 30-second moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. At this time, we would like to welcome anyone who is here with 30 days or less of sobriety. If that is you, we are especially grateful that you are here. Please raise your hand and identify your name and disease so we can welcome you. Nick, welcome.
Hi, Dwayne, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dwayne, welcome. Okay. This workshop is being presented by District 7, Area 93. For those who may not be familiar, District 7 is part of the general service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous, which helps ensure that AA remains available to the alcoholic who still suffers. When contributions are made at meetings, they help support services such as literature, public information, corrections work, and the overall functioning of our fellowship. If you are interested in general service, please feel free to speak with me or any of the trusted servants here today. At this time, may I have a show of hands from those currently involved in general service who are available to serve as service sponsors? General service is open to all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It does not require any particular background or level of experience, only a willingness to serve. Many of us came in with zero knowledge, and through participation and service, have found a deeper understanding of our fellowship, our traditions, and our concepts. If anything you hear today sparks your curiosity, we encourage you to explore general service and to remember that you do not have to do it alone. I would like to thank all of you for being here today and to extend our gratitude to the panel participants for their willingness to share. Worksheets are available for your use. You are welcome to use them during the workshop or take them with you. There will be no required homework because no one likes homework or mandates. Coffee, I won't be taking one, but coffee, water, snacks are available. Please feel free to help yourself. Each panel speaker will be sharing for approximately 35 minutes. Following the panel, we will have a question and answer session. In keeping with our tradition of anonymity, we ask that you please refrain from taking photographs, particularly where others may be visible, unless you have their permission. At this time, we will now welcome and begin with our panel speakers. And our first panel speaker is going to be Jenny.
Hi,
Jenny.
Thank you, Carissa. Thank you for all the work that you do as our GSR. Thank you, Judy, for asking me to be on this panel. There you are. When Judy asked me,
I already had plans for today. I was going to the Pacoima Alcathon because the Rafters has a time slot this afternoon, and I was going to be of service with my sponsor there. So I called her, and I asked her, Judy asked me to speak at a District 7 meeting, and I said, but it's the same time as the Raptors time slot. And she said, oh, no, dear, you need to go where Judy asks you to go. Power. They say there's no power in Alcoholics Anonymous, but there you are. There you are. I'd like to welcome Nick and Dwayne. I hope you find here what I found. You know, my solution is in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship, the God of my understanding, my sponsor, and so on. I could make a long list. I'll tell you a little bit about myself just so you know my background, so you know where I'm coming from and what made me the kind of person that likes to control every single bit of my life. My sobriety date is 11/12/13. I know sequential numbers. I think I gotta keep this one, you know, because it wasn't my first. It was not my first sobriety date. I came in 2008, got 22 months of sobriety. I was a greeter at a very big meeting on Sundays and got to know everybody, stuck my hand out. I felt really good not having the alcohol obsession. And I was on my merry way. You know, I was going to a lot of meetings, fellowship. I was secretary of two meetings. And yet it was Christmas time and I was decorating, and I always associated that with so much joy and fun and gaiety and let's make it pretty, and every little nook and cranny of the house has to be decorated, and outside, by the way. And I hit that mental blank spot, and I was in a new community, and they had just put in a BevMo. And, you know, when they just put in a BevMo, they send you coupons in the mail. And I went in the house. I was working outside. I remember distinctly what I was doing. I was putting mini lights on the rose bushes in the front. I remember distinctly what I was doing, and that urge, that obsession came back. And I went in the house, got that coupon, and I went down to BevMo and bought a bottle of wine, because wine was my thing. And I drank, and I was bewildered. I could not figure out what in the world I was thinking. I drank that bottle of wine, and my bottom was with vodka, and that bottle of wine didn't suffice. So I went right back to the vodka, and I drank and drank and drank. And after a few weeks, I came back to the rooms and started taking my chips again. Lasted maybe not even 60 days, and I was out again. And I did that for the next 3 years. So when I landed on 11/12/13, I thought, man, this is as good a day as any to finally wave that white flag and surrender. Surrender is not my natural state at all, never was. When I was a kid, I grew up in an absolutely leave it to beaver home. Mom stayed at home, was Martha Stewart on steroids. Everything was immaculate, from the crisp bed sheets that she put on our beds, mm-hmm. to our lunches that she made and the brown paper bags and folded down with a tight crease at the top. And delicious food and love, lot of love, lot of love. And then some bad things happened to me that was no fault of my mom or dad. And I was a preteen and I get totally confused because I had grown up in this loving, perfect home. And grew up in the Presbyterian church, had a wonderful time in that church, going to Sunday school and meeting people and knowing God. You know, that's how I got to know God. And the Presbyterian church does not have a punishing God, very loving, kind God. But my interpretation at that stage of my life was that God didn't protect me. I turned my back on God, would never go back to church, and became this fiercely independent young kid, teenager by this time. I didn't take a lot of, I mean, I drank some in high school and smoked some marijuana with my friends and, you know, thought I was cool. And I wasn't, but I thought I was. But I was a good kid. I got great grades. I studied like crazy, even though I have a little bit of a disability with reading. I'm a little, I don't know if you can be a little dyslexic, but I'm dyslexic. Well, I just got to pretty it up, you know. So anyway, I was bound and determined to get myself into a spot where I did not have to have anybody at all look after me or take care of me. So I got into a good college, went to nursing school, graduated from Mount St. Mary's College in 1977. And at the same time, I was working at UCLA as a, you know, ward secretary, sit behind the desk, answer the phone, you know, direct people, that kind of thing. And then once I became a nurse, I started working on the pediatric floor. And I worked, to make a long story short, at UCLA for 37 years until I retired. So I was a functional alcoholic. I never lost my job. I made a great deal of money. At the time, the university had an incredible retirement program. I was able to retire from that job with 90% of my ending salary. And they don't do that anymore. But, you know, I fortunately never lost employment there. Fortunately or not fortunately, I had no consequences is what I'm trying to say. You know, I got to drink. I had two kids. I did everything with them. I took them to their baseball practice. I kept score at their baseball games. My daughter was in dance and in theater arts. I took her to every play she was in and leading most of them, did all of that stuff for them. And yet, when, you know, as soon as I got home, I was jonesing for that drink. And I tell this story a lot in my Women's Stags. I'd be driving home from work and start to feel the effects of withdrawal from alcohol. And I would get off Burbank Boulevard off the 405 because there was a BevMo there. And I'd buy a bottle of wine. I had a bottle opener next to me in my door. I had random cups that I would buy from BevMo, because sometimes they didn't have a cup. So I have all these random glasses that I'd buy from BevMo. I pour myself a big glass of the wine and start drinking, and I would drink all the way home. And I did that over and over and over again. And I never realized that normal people didn't do that stuff. You know, normal people don't do that kind of stuff. So anyway, here I am, this very independent person. I can manage my household. I can manage my job. I can manage my children. They're doing great. They're both, one's a doctor now. The other one works HR at UCLA. Both of them are doing terrific. So I have this, these kids that are on track. I can take care of everything, all my problems, except I cannot take care of the alcohol problem. I'm starting to realize I'm a real alcoholic. I'm starting to have withdrawals by 2 o'clock in the afternoon at work. I'm shaking, my handwriting changes, I'm sweaty. So I go to my doctor. I said, this job is so stressful. Can't you give me something to take the edge off? She writes me a prescription for some Ativan. Nice. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd pop one of those. It would take me until I could get to BevMo. best formula ever. I never abused it. I didn't take it other than that when I started to get the shakes. My doctor didn't realize my shakes and my anxiety was because I was withdrawing from alcohol. So, I'm a true alcoholic, right? But I don't know what to do about this little alcohol problem. My sister is the alcoholic of the family. She rolls cars on the freeway. She embezzles money from her job. She's in jail. She has 5 different husbands. Literally 5 husbands. She is total, talk about the tornado in the book, in the big book. She's it, right? So I know she's a drug addict and alcoholic, right? But how can I have this just alcohol problem, you know, and can't manage it? Well, my family finally sets me down. I'm doing things that are incomprehensibly demoralizing. Like, for example, I'm at my son's baseball game, keeping score in the score box, which is behind home plate. And I've got a nice tumbler. Nice tumbler. Yes, a vodka. And the score desk is slanted this way. So I've got this and it, and we have always two scorekeepers and the lady's like, oh. And I'm like, nothing to see here, Ma. You know, my family sat me down and they said, you know, you're drinking too much. And I said, I know. I know. I said, I'll go to AA. So I called central office. Thank you, Judy, and all the people that make central office run. And thank you for everybody who donates money to central office. They really need our cash these days. And I love central office. Anyway, I get a hold of a man. Hello. I think I need rehab. And he says, ma'am, we don't do rehab here, but I can have a woman call you and set you up with some meetings you can go to. And I say, okay, Jay, his name is Jay, Jay, B, JB, right?
Jay Bradshaw.
Yep. JB. Thank God for JB. So he sends me to a women's stag at Stepping Stones on, well, oh no, that didn't happen. Sorry. Sorry. I'm getting older, a little dementia mixed in with some, a little nervous too. Anyway, what time do I have? Where am I?
15 minutes.
Okay, good.
Excuse me, 20 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Okay. I know I'm spending a lot of time on this, but I want you to understand me, right? And how I navigate these things. So anyway, Kathy E calls me. Jay tells Kathy E, we got a woman that wants to go to AA. She calls me up. She says, I'll meet you on Thursday at the Women's Stag. And I say, okay. But I didn't, or whatever, realize, well, maybe you shouldn't drink before you go to that meeting. So I show up reeking from alcohol. You know, I don't know how to go to AA meeting yet. I don't know. I know nothing. So, of course, I smell like alcohol. One of the girls gives me a big hug and goes, we got a wet one here. Do you think I wanted to run out the door? Anyway, she wouldn't let go of me. She goes, we're gonna sit you down. We're gonna talk to you. I want you to listen to the meeting. And afterwards, we're all going out for coffee and you're coming with us. And I said, okay. So that was the beginning of my journey, of my 22 months of really wonderful sobriety. What happened? I had failed to enlarge my spiritual life. When that blank spot hit, I didn't say, God, please take this obsession back away from me. My obsession had lifted. Please take it away. I had a blank spot. I had not enlarged my spiritual life so that my connection with my higher power was there when I needed it most. I had already cut myself off. I was doomed. Anyway, so we land on 11, 12, 13. I get sober. I find a sponsor who's very God-centered. Her whole program, excuse me, I thought I turned this off. Her whole program is God-centered. I pick her. She takes me through the book. She takes me through the steps again. And I surrendered. That is my state these days. I wake up in the morning, and if I don't feel surrender, I ask God, help me feel that surrender so that I can do your will. So why am I here today? How change affects my sobriety. When I was 3 years sober, my mom got sick. And she was living in Eagle Rock where I grew up. My dad had already passed away. And it was pretty clear, it was getting high time, that she needed care. Not a lot, but, you know, to be in a safer environment than this big house by herself. So I had been going, I'm retired by then, and I would go and take her to all her myriad of doctor appointments and so forth. But it was getting a lot, you know, driving back and forth to Eagle Rock, all these appointments, la, la. So we started talking about selling the house and have her move in with me. And I have a beautiful home, plenty of room. She loves my home. By this time, I have one grandchild. And so she moves in with me. And it's a lot, right? I kind of have my own groove going on. I'm taking care of my grandkids, my grandbaby. 5 days a week until about 3 in the afternoon. And now I have mom in the mix. So, and she's great. She can do her own laundry. She can go up and down the stairs for her bedroom. It's safe for her. She can fix her breakfast. I fix her dinner. And you know, it goes pretty good. She has some annoying habits that just about drove me insane for a long time. She whistled and hummed. And it was just that, you know, and when you have a last nerve, and then she always had to be making a small noise. So it would be and she would tap, tap.
Oh
so I have my last nerve and I call my sponsor and she says, you know, you can tell her that that's bothering her or you can ask God to remove the annoyance just from your mind, you know, make it like, okay. And it worked out, you know, I survived that. She,
congratulations.
But, you know, here I am taking care of my grandkid, looking after my mom and her needs, all her appointments. We change all her doctors to up here, to local doctors up here. And, you know, what I haven't stopped doing, and this is really important. I never stop going to meetings. I might have to shift my meetings, the times a little bit, but you know, mom likes to eat early, 5 o'clock. So I can get to a lot of 6 o'clock meetings that my women's stags are at. I'm working intensely with my sponsor because it's a big deal. I have a lot of responsibility. And I want to read this right now because it pertains. It's on page 68 in the big book. And Chris, Marissa was there the other day when we talked about this paragraph in our book study. And it's the paragraph, perhaps there is a better way. We think so. We are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigned. Oh, boy. Here I am. I'm retired. Here I am taking care of a grandkid. Here I am taking care of my mom. I wanted to be traveling.
Way to go.
I wanted to be able to have the freedom of going where I want and when I want. But then it says here, we are in the world to play the role he assigns. And then it says, and here's a promise, just to the extent that we do as he think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. I love that paragraph because I was very obviously a self-centered, self-propelled, self-indulgent alcoholic. And, you know, my little plans for my life just weren't going to go my way. So my mom lives with me for 6 years and passes away at the age of 92. So by this time, I have two grandkids. Now I'm taking care of two little boys. But yet I was able to provide a comforting, lovely home for my mom the entire time. And she loved having those grandkids around. She absolutely loved it. She thrived on it. She couldn't wait for them to come in the morning. She would sit at our kitchen table and do, you know, child type jigsaw puzzles with them. She was very engaged with them. And, you know, her final years were serene, calm, no drama, no chaos, because I'm a sober alcoholic. So my mom passes away. It's been 3 years now. And just at that time, my daughter-in-law, the one who has these two sons, and my son with my son, so my daughter-in-law, starts to fall, starts falling and tripping and dragging her foot behind her. She's a wedding photographer. She's a photographer for events, like if you have a kid's birthday party or a wedding or whatever. So she's on her feet, right? She needs both those legs to be working. So she starts doctoring. What's the matter with my foot? Oh, you have foot drop. You may have MS. So they start this diagnostic workup that is like goes on for a year, basically. But her symptoms are getting worse. She's starting to feel the same thing in her other leg. She's falling at venues when she's doing photography and guests have to help her back up. My son on weekends, because these shoots are on weekends, I take the kids. He goes with her, help her do these wedding shoots. Well, it's starting to get really bad, and the doctors have ruled out everything they can think of, and she ends up being diagnosed with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a devastating, deadly neurologic condition. She gets that diagnosis right when my mom passes away. So I go from taking care of mom to starting to take care of my daughter-in-law. She ends up in a wheelchair. She can still do a lot of things. We start completely redoing the inside of their home. Tear out a downstairs bathroom and make it into a big type shower room that she can go in there and sit in a shower chair to shower. I put in a ramp for their staircase so she can sit in the chair and safely make it up the stairs. The last time I tried to make her up the stair, help her up the stairs before we put in the stair lift, I was literally behind her, pushing her step by step and picking up her legs. It was a nightmare. We put ramps everywhere in the house. It's all wheelchair fitted now, and she's got a place to shower. They modify her bed so that she can have it raised. She's starting to lose function in her hands. She needs a BiPAP machine so she can breathe. It's this big thing that goes up her nostrils and just shoves air into her face. She has to keep her mouth closed because if she opens her mouth, the air that the ventilator gives her just comes out her mouth. She can't swallow now. She can no longer eat. She has to have a feeding tube placed. So I have these two little boys, right? They're now both in school. They're dealing with this as best they can. They're children, so they, you know, they seem to take it in stride. It's amazing. They know mommy's very, very different and very, very sick. 5 minutes. Perfect. So now she's in this wheel, she's either in bed or a wheelchair. She has full-time 24/7 care. 2 months ago, they did a tracheostomy, and now she's on a ventilator. She is complete, total care. The only thing that she can do is, thank God for technology, she's got a machine, computer thing, that attaches to either her wheelchair or her bedside table, and she can text with her eyes.
Wow.
And send messages to her boys.
Wow.
There's a speaker downstairs in their family room, and the computer is connected to that speaker. And the voice that comes out is the computer voice. But, you know, I was down over there the other day, fixing their kids, the kids their snacks after school, and I hear this, "It's time to stop playing your iPads and do your homework." You know, if I'm not sober, what does this look like? The financial strain is horrendous on top of it. I give them what I can, which is a lot. She needs 24/7 care. She has six people that work with her. She's dying. We don't know when. The doctors don't say, oh, she's not going to make it past X. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't say that. Now that she has her trach, I forgot to tell you, she had a cardiac arrest 4 months ago. My son had to do CPR. She was in the ICU for a month after, for a week after that, and with memory loss. So I stay sober. I take care of my grandkids the best I can. I show up as grandma. I keep doing my program, my tools, prayer and meditation. I just went to a woman's retreat. That's a tool right there, right? We talked about our roots, the roots of sobriety in our foundation. Are our roots in a good foundation? I can happily say to all of you today that my roots are in my foundation. I'm current with my sponsor. I do service work. I'm an intergroup rep for a meeting. And I go to 5 or 6 meetings a week because that's where I hear the message. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you. Okay, now we're going to go on to our next panel speaker. That's going to be Steve. Everyone, welcome Steve.
Steve.
Hi, my name's Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
Thank you for the opportunity to do this. I got sober and 2020, and it took me about a year. And, you know, before that, I went through all the, you know, I think probably typical stages. I didn't drink until I was 21. And I got sober when I was, I think, 38. And I didn't have the experience that some people say. I was immediately, you know, an alcoholic. It just very gradually, you know, came to be, you know, a big part of my life. And, you know, it was kind of like, you know, some problems crop up, you know, some problems continue, problems get like astoundingly worse. And, you know, what happened was, you know, I ended up having this very savage master, which was alcohol. And, you know, I don't know anything about drugs. It doesn't matter because I had this terrible combination of I liked drinking. I didn't really know if I was going to drink or if I wasn't, even if I shouldn't, you know, maybe I could. And when I did drink, again, problems, you know, and, you know, I graduated to, you know, finding out I could drink in the morning. And that led to, you know, very predictable things like, you know, missing the flight, not going to work, you know, during COVID. It was possible to work from home. And so I tried that also. And, you know, I tried, you know, drinking a little, you know, maybe this much and, you know, trying to function. And, you know, people would call me and I'd have to pretend I was on a call because I you know, couldn't answer. Turns out I couldn't also text because, you know, spelling errors and stuff like that. And, you know, it was hard to figure out. I knew I was going to have to dial it back a bit. And I didn't know how exactly I was going to do that, but I fancied myself a pretty smart guy. I'd solved a lot of problems. You know, I had, you know, I invented a knot that got adopted, like, you know, widely in a segment of climbing. And I'm like, I should be able to figure out, you know, how to control my drinking because I certainly enjoyed it. And, you know, and, you know, I kind of passed through, you know, there's this twilight of where, you know, it's not working. I would, you know, I have these, you know, terrible memories of, you know, I'd awake and, you know, I'm on the floor and it's kind of light outside and I don't know if it's getting light or if it's getting dark. And, you know, even now I just, in the pit of my stomach, you know, and I don't want to forget where I came from, but I couldn't solve this problem. And, I had to, you know, swear off and, not drink for like probably like a year, year and a half, you know, to finish, you know, school and stuff like that, which I did successfully. But, you know, I always knew I would make a, return and, you know, be able to enjoy my drinking again. It would have to be secret because I wasn't supposed to be doing it. And I remember, you know, the place where I lived, somebody had, you know, it's an apartment and somebody had set like two Modellos out. They were these big fat ones on their, on the little porch. And like they obviously didn't need them. They were going to throw them out. I walked by these things for, must have been 10 or 14 days. And I'd look at them when I walked by, you know, I certainly thought about it, but, you know, and, I don't know what happened. One day I took them and I put them in the fridge and they got a little bit cold and you know, I drank the first one. It was the best beer I've ever had. It was amazing. I just, it was like, you know, all the good that I associated with alcohol, the taste, you know, the feeling, everything came back. And the two beers was like enough to get me drunk, but it was also enough to, you know, start everything over again. And so I would, on my way from home from work, I would stop at a liquor store near where I worked because I didn't want anyone I knew who might see me, like, you know, and I would buy something, you know, put it in the trunk of the car and stuff like that. And, you know, this went exactly where you would all expect. And to my, you know, I was aware of that there was this thing, Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew what an alcoholic was. You know, they, you know, slept on benches, drank out of bags and stuff like that. I wasn't one of those. I knew that was true. And so, you know, and at one point, one of my parents, I can't remember who, even asked me if I thought about it. And I was like, no, it doesn't, you know, it does not apply to me. I'll take care of it. And, and I couldn't. And, you know, I finally wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there's a window of opportunity when things are, you know, just bad enough. And apparently things hadn't gone quite bad enough because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like looking at the walls. I'm like, this is pretty hooky. But maybe, you know, Perhaps I can do it on the cheap, right? Like maybe I can just, you know, pick up a few things that will help me and I, you know, don't have to stick around, right? You know, like maybe I'll get a certificate or something. And I think I was willing to get the certificate, like, you know, show people, like, you know, got the certificate, like, you no longer need to worry, stop asking me about this kind of stuff. And, you know, I spent a fairly miserable year, you know, getting drunk a few more times during that year. And I honestly don't know if I knew it was, you know, coming or, you know, and it, been thinking about it and just waiting for the right moment, or if it took me by surprise, I don't know. But it was, you know, by the end, it was undeniably outside my control. And you know, I fancied myself a fairly sophisticated drinker. You know, I like to, you know, go to BevMo. I like to drink neat gin. You know, I'd wear linen pants and a button-down shirt and sit in the pool. But I would also, you know, wake up on the floor and you know, have, you know, it'd be like mustard and crackers on the counter. I don't know who was eating those. You know, they go to the bathroom, but I got mustard on my shirt, you know, stuff like that. But,
that's a lot.
You know, it just wasn't working. And, you know, during the first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't really think I fit, right? And so, you know, I would listen and, you know, women would say, you know, I come home every evening and it's me and my cat and I have a few glasses of wine and I really know I shouldn't. And I'm thinking like, lady, like, you know, you don't understand. And then I would listen to people who've had, you know, 16 car crashes and stuff like that. And like, gee whiz, that guy needs to get it together. But I didn't see myself on the same level as anyone. And I made no connections with anyone. And, you know, actually what proved to be, you know, a blessing was, you know, I got sober during COVID and it wasn't like the Zoom meetings. I ended up at a backyard meeting and I recognized, you know, there's about 30 guys and I recognized most of them. And I was intimidated by some of them for sure. And because they, you know, they were crusty old timers, right? And, you know, by then I knew I couldn't do it, but I couldn't figure it out. You know, I couldn't survive drinking. I couldn't, avoid drinking. It was a terrible trap. And, you know, my life, which seemed like it had so much promise, you know, I couldn't believe it had come to this. And I remember, you know, just, you know, I was probably crying, you know, praying to God at the end. I just want another chance, right? And, you know, I want another chance on my terms. I want this on my terms, that on my terms. Yeah, I'm very good at writing the script. People and things just do not follow it. And Alcoholics Anonymous was not the way I envisioned, you know, a second chance at life. And, but this was how God chose, you know, and this is what I believe, this is how God chose to work in my life, was through the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is, it was not what I was expecting. You know, there's certain things that, you know, are context dependent. If I do it just right, maybe it'll work. You know, if I go like say the right joke, maybe the girl will give me her number and they think. And some things are not context dependent. You just do it and it works. If I go into the gas station and give them money, I will be able to get gas, right? It's not like if I give them the money just right. And, you know, initially I thought, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, like if I do it just right and like, you know, a little of this, a little of that, you know, maybe I can somehow, you know, get it to work, and I couldn't. And it turns out what worked for me was, following a completely, you know, so my experience was, you know, when I start drinking, the phone's ringing a lot because I'm not doing the things I'm supposed to do. And people notice, you know, you're not going to your job, you're not, you know, whatever. After a while, the phone stops ringing. And my experience each time I tried to get sober during that first year was, phone is not, that thing will not beep in a week. Nobody wants anything to do with me. And, you know, it was just what I needed. It was complete, like, desolation. And that's exactly what I needed. And so the, you know, contrary to getting the certificate on my terms, what I found was it worked, you know, after my complete unconditional surrender. And I'm not sure it was any virtue of mine. I simply had no other choice. There was nothing left to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the grace of God, you know, the men in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, showed me how, and the experience I had was not rocket science. You know, it does not have to be done just exactly perfectly right. I just had to do it. Mm-hmm. And the fact I never thought I would be, you know, sitting here at a table saying, I'm a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And it's my, you know, sincere hope that anybody who needs an answer the way I did, you know, knows that there's one here. And, you know, what I think one of the things that made the difference for me was I'm a head of lettuce. I better go find a salad. You know, I need to, no. Like I need to find, like, you know, I got to be part of the group. I can't, you know, I tried, you know, coming in right before the meeting starts, sitting in the corner, you know, that seat under the light switch. And then as soon as we were done, I would leave. Right. And, you know, I was not part of the group.
Hmm.
And this backyard meeting, I ended up being, you know, part of the group. And, you know, today I'm part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not part of all the groups within Alcoholics Anonymous. There are groups, there are cliques. That's a fact. But I'm part of some of them. And, you know, I found the salad that I belong in. You like that. I've been, you know, sober for 5 years, and I'm living the bonus round, and I sometimes forget that.
Yeah.
And if I sit here and talk through it, you know, I feel grateful for it again, but, you know, that's not always the case. And, mm-hmm. and what I've found, I have no idea what the time is.
Mm-hmm. What is it, Marissa?
21 minutes.
Elapsed.
Left.
Oh, I can slow way down.
5 minute warning.
Okay. Yeah, I can slow it down.
Yeah, you can.
And, you know, none of this has been on my terms, right? Like none of my life, you know, I can sketch out the perfect design. It never works that way. Sometimes it's better. Sometimes it's different. Sometimes it's not as good as I wanted it to be, but it's never the way I thought it, you know, should be. And, and that's just life. And, you know, so with, you know, a couple years of sobriety, you know, I had a job that I liked, and I got laid off from the job. And, you know, look at the worksheet, career, job, finances, relation, you know, like it impacted, you know, a lot of these things. And, you know, being unemployed, you know, it's not just the money aspect, but, you know, this was what I did every day. And suddenly I've got, you know, loads of time to sit around, apply for questionable jobs and stuff like that. And, you know, and my experience was it got more questionable, you know, the longer it went. And, you know, there were jobs that I thought, you know, maybe I should take, you know, I didn't. And, you know, eventually God provided, you know, another job for me that's better than the one I left, but I couldn't have seen it. I couldn't have written that script. And, you know, I'm not in control, and that's probably good.
Mm.
You know, and I'm looking at these talking points here, which, you know, how change affects my sobriety, and change. I am down with change as long as it's something I like. You know, give me a new car, like that'll be fine. You know. But a lot of the changes, you know, that happen, you know, they may not be things I like. And, you know, some of them I can get used to. But, you know, like many others, I'm sure, you know, I'm prone to, you know, fear, anxiety, you know, all these things. You know, I have this very strong desire to be self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes uncertainty really difficult for me to, you know, difficult for me to deal with. And, you know, I look here at the, you know, the warning signs, right? Like, I need to be connected to a group of other alcoholics because I'm not the best judge of, you know, what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm not the best judge of what's going on. You know, I'm naturally kind of an island unto myself. So I'm not going to ding myself for isolating, skipping meetings. I'm very busy, you know, and so forth. So, you know, for me, you know, I think it's important that I have a circle in Alcoholics Anonymous and they know what meetings to expect me at because I'm there every week. You know, they know where I sit. You know, I have an assigned seat because I'm sitting it every week and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm very fortunate since I got sober through Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what I thought was at the beginning, I thought that, you know, people would sit there and they would represent that they're, you know, feel calm in their own skin and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I figured they must not have what I have because, mm-hmm. You know, I was hanging on by my fingernails. And I thought I would always be hanging on by my fingernails. And I couldn't imagine, you know, life without alcohol. And to my surprise, you know, the attractiveness of drinking left. You know, I don't, you know, every now and then you'll see like a cold beer with like the water on the outside. You're like, oh, that looks nice. But it's not like I want one.
Yeah.
You know, I know what'll happen if I have one, and I don't have to, you know, scare myself away from it. It's just, you know, truly I'm neutral toward it. And so, you know, if I were to be romanticizing drinking, I should be locked up, you know, because that's, for me, that's going to be a very advanced, you know, event stage. And the next thing is there's smoke coming out. Yeah, you know, I was talking with Norm, you know, before the meeting and you know, he mentioned the word acceptance, and that's, you know, that's my only choice. And I don't like the idea of accepting things, but I have no choice. You know, I can't control stuff. And I remember very early on somebody, you know, was asking me, how much control do you think you have over your life? And I'm like, well, listen here, I control this and this. And they're like, really? Are you sure? And, you know, that's what I thought. And now I realize I control very little. You know, I can, you know, control where my feet go, sometimes what comes out of my mouth. But, you know, obviously I can't control what goes in my mouth or I wouldn't be here. But, you know, I just... And I, you know, I didn't, you know, earn acceptance or anything. I think it just, you know, sort of, you know, comes with, I think, you know, as I've matured after, you know, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, these tools that help me stay sober, you know, sure, all of them. But, you know, very important, you know, meetings, not just because I need to go to a meeting and listen, but because that's how I am part of a group. That's how I participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I withdraw from Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I think I'll find myself on my own again. And that's what got me here in the first place. And, you know, I was in a meeting this morning and the topic of the meeting was, you know, why are you here? And people got up and gave a wide range of legitimate answers. I don't want to forget where I came from. You know, this and that. And, you know, I was there because I always go to that meeting, always, unless I'm out of town. But I was there because I like it. I like the meeting. I like the people in Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm pretty motivated to find ways around doing things I don't like. If this, you know, and in the beginning, it was kind of eating my vegetables, and I didn't really. I don't like vegetables. I didn't really want to do it. The salad thing, but yeah. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous Day. I like going to the meetings I go to, and you know, that's makes it a lot easier to stay involved, and it's not a chore. It's you know, it's a, you know, one of the bright spots, you know, in my life. And I think, you know, there's an old timer who probably, you know, he's not the first guy who said this, but you know, said it's not, you know, did you surrender? It's are you surrendered? Mm-hmm. And you know, I think I've got a pretty decent chance if I stay surrendered. And you know, this last point here, you know, reflection. You know, what does staying sober through life's changes make possible for my life? And I'm still suffering alcoholic today. I love being right. And I love being right. And it causes so much trouble for me. And
you know,
I think I'd be better off if I liked it a little less, but that's just not how it is. But I think the reason I like I like being right is I think I've got this desire. I want to be relevant. I want to be you know, relevant to what's going on, and I want to be useful.
Mm.
And I am useful to absolutely no one. You know, if I'm drinking, I can help no one, not even myself. And the only way that I'm relevant is I'm a liability. I'm a problem. And that's not the case today. You know, thank God. And you know, so if I can stay sober through the various challenges that I've, you know, had and will have, you know, I've got parents, they're not getting any younger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think about that sometimes. I have a chance to be helpful and useful to others. And some of those are people I haven't met yet. Some of those are people that I really owe it to, you know, like my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's a pretty good motivator. And I'm drawn to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous because what it's done for me. I am, you know, I am blessed beyond measure. You know, if I thank God I didn't get what I had coming, you know, what I had set in motion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am so grateful. And, you know, yeah, I think, you know, everyone's an example of something. And, you know, some people are good examples of what doesn't work or what not to do. Mm-hmm. And I was that example. And I hope now, you know, I can be an example of, you know, what does work. And, my experience has been, you know, simply one foot in front of the other, just execute to the best of my ability. And Alcoholics Anonymous has completely changed my life. And, you know, it's the last place I wanted to be, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me. And, you know, my hope is if I can be that example for, you know, anybody who's in that position where, you know, they maybe aren't sure if there's an answer for, you know, their problem. Cause I thought I had a different problem than everybody else because this couldn't work for what I have. And I found out I was wrong, and, you know, and thank God. So yeah, thanks for the invite to do this today. I appreciate it very much. And, thank you guys.
Okay, so our next speaker is going to be Annette.
It is?
Okay. It is.
Well, hi, I'm Annette. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Jenny. And thank you so much, Steve. Welcome, Nick. And Dwayne just got up, but welcome. I appreciate you asking me to do this. Thank you. My sobriety date is January 27th, 2014. It wasn't my first one. My first one was in November of 1988, when I was still at Hart High School. And I was in a peer counseling class, and one of the people in the peer counseling class was sober, and the teacher thought it would be a good idea for people that wanted to be peer counseling to know more about people that drank and used. So I walked up the steps to the rafters, and people were smoking, so that was great, you know. And I felt absolutely home the second I was there. I knew they were my people. I knew that I had been drinking alcoholically since I was probably 11. I'm one of those. I've been this height since I was 11, and I have that personality where I have no problem being 11 years old and putting on a bunch of makeup and walking into a liquor store, hey, and getting what I need. And it was hard and fast, my relationship with alcohol from the beginning. All I ever wanted to do was be a grown-up. I started smoking very early, drinking very early, having sex too early. Just, I could, and I had a family that encouraged that kind of behavior. I could drive. My dad likes to hunt, so I grew up with access to land. So I'm probably 9 or 10 with a loaded gun, driving around in a Jeep, stealing beer. So that was my childhood. And I was the girl with all the gifts. I have a big personality. I'm naturally athletic. I was the prom queen. I mean, that's all I have to tell you. But I'm also this tortured soul. I hang out with, I'm great at picking very nice people to hang out with that are going to put up with my debauchery. I need people to hold my hair back. I need people to drive me home. I need people to take care of me, because that's the kind of drunk that I am. And I'm young, and I'm really grateful for the friends that I had, because they weren't doing the drugs, it would have got me in serious trouble. And they got me home, and they kept me away from people that take advantage of very young girls that drink like I was drinking. So I feel very fortunate. And like Jenny, I had a very high bottom. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous because I got sober right then and there, right when I was in high school. I graduated high school when I was sober, and I moved to London to go to school after high school, and I was going to meetings, and there was amazing celebrities. You guys, if you got sober in 88, I mean, you're walking into meetings and you're like, oh, there's the lead singer of my favorite band. There's this famous actress. There is one of the most famous singers from England you ever heard of, and he's sitting next to me. I mean, it was a golden era. And there was some guy, you know, at the rafters, high school dropout at table 2. Perfect for me. So about a year in, I met him, and he didn't make it. He drank. And my ism started coming back, you know, my ego. I was young, and my life got good fast because I had quit drinking. I was able to figure out how to go to college. I was able to figure out to get, I still do the job that I got when I was in high school. So I've been a fitness professional for 37 years. I was keeping it together, but there was no break on my ego. And I wasn't doing the steps. The steps were over here on the wall. They weren't in the book. They were just floating around, which is something I heard at that convention, that women's retreat this weekend that I loved. And it just took one person to make one comment to me. And, you know, it's F you. I don't need you guys. I'm out. So I'm the kind of person that once I decide that something's not right for me and I'm a know-it-all. So I went out for 22 years. And I worked, and I got married, and I had two boys, and it all looked amazing. on paper and in pictures. But I'm a tortured soul. Nothing's ever good enough. I'm never good enough. If the people around me don't get it together, I can't be happy. And that is absolute reality for me. And if I can't be happy with what you're doing, I'm going to try to control you. I'm going to try to manipulate you. I'm going to try to get what I want to, because I'm not happy. I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontent. But I learned enough from you guys back in the high school days to know that I better not do drugs and I better lay off the hard stuff. And so I love when we read, we have tried every imaginable means we can think of. And that was me. I'm just going to drink natural wines. I'm going to read every self-help book. I'm going to become a yoga instructor as well. And I'm going to travel to Asia and wear beads and flowing gowns. And I'm going to learn how to chant in Sanskrit. And I'm going to, you know, hike in Peru. Like, I want it to be huge, larger than life. And so I just went on this external safari of spirituality. And then I couldn't stop. My oldest son, I have two sons, and my oldest son was born with a severe dent in his sternum. And he went in for surgery, and they punctured his heart during surgery. And the doctor who did it had to put his finger, like the guy in the dike in the wall, in my son's heart until the heart surgeon could come in. And they put a 14-inch scar across his chest, and he was in ICU for 20 days. And that was the moment that my alcoholism really got good. Now, I don't know what kind of family y'all have, but my parents, when they would drive down, they knew. They would walk in with a couple shopping bags, and they would be bottles of wine. That incident fixed my relationship with my dad. Just to kind of give you a little more context about the kind of life. I wasn't just driving around in a Jeep with a shotgun. I have the type of father, and I love this man. He's still with us at 80 years old. He's probably at work right now. He said, "Have you left here?" And I go, "No, Dad." I said, "John is in ICU. He's got 5 different tubes down him. I don't have anywhere more important to be." And he looked at me and he said, "You're a good man." Because that's the only language my father has. There's no adjectives for women. I'm a good man. So I'm a good man. And I sat in that hospital, but they knew to bring me wine. They knew it. And that's when it got a little gnarly. Because now, even though I am, you know, I haven't lost my job and I'm still going to work and I only start drinking at 5 and la la la. And I'm in a bad marriage, but I'm going to make it work because he lets me drink the way I want to drink. And if it gets violent, if I get verbally abusive, if it gets ugly, I can just say I was drinking, you know, sorry. Yeah, but I'm still cute, so. I mean, it's just unbelievable to look back on it. So I start trying to quit. And that's around the time I started getting really into yoga, not just on top of the normal stuff that I do. I'm a avid outdoor mountain biker, love to, I'm outside all the time. And when I got into yoga teacher training and we started reading about the philosophy, which is thousands of years old, there's another person that read about the philosophies that were studied in yoga. His name was Emmett Fox and Bill W. And when I started studying, I heard some things that I couldn't deny. It said alcohol will stunt your emotional growth and alcohol will dull your intuition. Now, we all have our little moment, but I always really thought of myself as an intuitive person. That was my spirituality. I didn't grow up with church. Okay. My dad had gone, that same dad. He had been forced to go to Catholic school, and he got kicked out of Catholic school because he tried to blow up the Monsignor's car. And so he transferred to Burbank High, got set up on a blind date with my mother, and they're still married. So that was, you know, we're not going to church. So when I read that and it says, this is going to stunt your intuition and your emotional growth, I cannot deny my alcoholism anymore. And I walk up the stairs to the rafters after 22 years. Mm-hmm. And two people that I had gotten sober with are there. One of them, you might know him. His name is Sal. He took a 6-month chip in the meeting that I was the secretary of. And then I saw Glenn. Hadn't seen Glenn in decades. And there he was. I got sober when Kathy H. Had 2 years. I used to go to lunch with Phil Stone. There was great people, but I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. The steps were on the wall. I did some of them, guys. But I jumped around. So I had stole some stuff from my aunt, and I gave it back. But I don't have time to sponsor you guys because I'm busy. I took a searching and fearless moral inventory of anyone that had ever hurt my feelings, of anyone that had ever done anything wrong to me, of my parents, and I'm talking paragraphs, you know, read it at my funeral because feel sorry for me. But there was no 6. There was no 7. There was an 8 of all the people that had harmed me. There was no 10. And the only 11 I had was a serenity prayer. And I did. I stayed that serenity prayer every single day since November of 1988. It can make me cry to think of it. It was that little thread that kept me connected to these rooms. And so I came back and I walked up those stairs and there they were. And I'm like, oh God, I hate this place. But that I didn't know about stepping stones. And I found a woman's group. Like you were talking about, I needed a strong woman's group and I found it, but I'm not as sick as you guys. So I go to one meeting a week and it's Thursday night and Jenny was there. And I just want to tell you, you know, it was really hard. I remember you talking about your mom and part of my story is I would kill for those problems. Right. We used to sit there and I talk about my alcoholic son and you talk about your mom and look where we are now. Yeah. I would kill for those problems. And I was obsessed with them because they were horrible and I couldn't take it because what happened is my youngest son at 14 years old got high at high in a junior high and he's one of those people and that's it. So the older son that had the heart surgery, he got better. He's normal. It's a rock climber. He's a great human being. My younger son is my heart. He's the one that looks like me, acts like me, always had a book. I love to read. Always was looking up math. He was, because I grew up camping, he was that kid you want to sit around the campfire with because you never know what's going to come out of his mouth. It's going to be so interesting. He has so many questions. He wants to talk about aliens and he wants to talk about physics and he just fascinating child. And he smoked weed. And that was it. Mm-hmm. And my son becomes a full blown alcoholic and drug addict, but he's doing it in a way that is so destructive that I can't understand it. He doesn't pick one thing. One week he's on acid. The next week he's on meth. Then he has alcohol. Then he finds cocaine. And he's getting himself so fucked up that he's going into psychosis. And we're getting calls that he's like in a wash, that he's in a gutter. I mean, he's a little boy. I'm sorry, but you know, I was 15 and thought, I told you, I was going into stores. I'd already been drinking for 4 years. I know what it's like to feel like an adult at 15. And you look at it, a 15-year-old now and you're horrified. Like put a diaper on him. Are you kidding me? That's a baby. And so my son starts using and drinking in a way that is so disturbing that I absolutely cannot deny it. And so I am going to save him, period. I spent $150,000 on my son's big book. Mm-hmm. I begged, borrowed, and I didn't steal. I begged and borrowed from family members. I took huge loans out on the equity of the home that I'd owned since 2000. I sent him off to the wilderness. I sent him to a boarding school. I did every one of the parent workshops. I flew back and forth to Tucson to do all the adaptive therapy, to be blindfolded and pet horses and all the things that you do. I sat across from that ex-husband of mine and realized that my 16-year-old and 18-year-old sons were emotionally more mature than he was, and I had to do it all by myself. He was cute, but he had never grown up at all. So I had three teenage boys that I lived with. And I was going to save my son. I was going to save him, and I was absolutely obsessed the way that only one of us can be obsessed. You ask me how I am, I tell you about my son. I don't know who I am anymore. And it was the worst thing that had ever, that could ever happen. I thought my son getting his chest cut open like that was going to be the worst thing that ever happened to me as a parent. He almost died. And then this. And I can't take it. My nervous system, you can still feel it for me right now. My nervous system got completely dysregulated. My adrenal glands burnt out. I'm going to save my kid, period. And when he came home after 14 months in treatment, I had like probably the best 4 months of my life. And then alcoholics and addicts do what alcoholics and addicts do. You cannot force us to get sober. You cannot. Now, I'm in Al-Anon by this point, too, and I'm so furious. Oh, God, have you ever gone to Al-Anon? Oh, my God. Yeah. You should go to this meeting in Pasadena. I drive all the way to Pasadena. They're like, if you're new, sit outside this tree. So I sit outside the tree, and some know-it-all woman comes over, and I go, I'm here to, you know, get my son sober. And she's like, oh, sweetie. We don't do that here. You're going to work on you. And I'm like, you tell me what to do to get this kid because I am going to die. I don't have the coping mechanisms to watch the love of my life kill himself. I can't do this. So you want to talk about things that can challenge your sobriety? This is my, I mean, there it is. I don't know what to do. Then in COVID hits, it scared him. A little bit straight for a little bit because it scared a lot of us. I mean, we're so busy washing our mail, we don't have time to buy meth. And then the addiction starts again, and he is going into psychosis, and I think he's on drugs. He's starting to talk to himself. We take a walk one day, and he goes, Mom, something's wrong with my brain. And I said, it's going to be okay. We're going to get you off these drugs, honey, and it's going to be okay. And I didn't know that was the last time I was ever going to talk to him. I didn't know. I just wish I would have told him I loved him. I wish I would have. By the way, he's not dead. The next day, he had a psychotic break, and he said that the CIA was in the backyard. And he took all this tinfoil and wrapped around his head. And I thought he was on drugs. I thought he was being funny. But at 19 years old, whatever he did broke his brain. And he went into the hospital and told them that me and his father were raping him. It was just unbelievable. I mean, I can't even explain to you the world of chaos I got thrown into. And when they finally decided to call me, because it turns out when someone's 19, they don't have to tell you anything. And people can tell you our mental health care system is broken, but you don't know how broken it is until your 19-year-old who thinks he's a pharaoh is trapped in a hospital in Northridge. And they won't call you to tell you what's wrong because of his rights even though he's now a sun god from Egypt. And so they sent home somebody I had never met. They sent home a person who didn't talk, who didn't bathe. If he did talk, he was screaming because there are spirit demons in his room. I've seen things that no parent should ever have to see. And he just gets dumped at my house, and all of a sudden I'm a mental health care facility, and I have no idea what to do. And I just watch my ex-husband go like this because his mother had schizophrenia. And I can't imagine what his childhood was like. And it's on a spectrum, just like autism. You can have autistic people that function and people that don't speak. My son is schizophrenic, low functioning. Oh, I'm sorry. He's schizoaffective, because you should throw a little bipolar in there. Well, I just have a thought disorder when you can also combine it with a mood disorder. And there's no place for him to go except for the wash, jail, or my house. So what happened? It was like someone took a pin out of a grenade and threw it into my house. And there was, my marriage cannot survive this, period. My older son. I mean, you guys, it got to a place where I'm like, I'm going to lose all three of them. My ex lost his mind. He's unable to seek help. I'm a person of action. I immediately went into meetings for mental health. I immediately started going into a thing called NAMI. I dove into Al-Anon. I did not take care of my sobriety. I couldn't. I don't even know who I am anymore. So everything blows up. I can't go to work. I can't be married anymore. If anyone ever in here has been divorced, and you know what's funny is I said to myself, well, nothing can be as bad as this kid losing his mind. Divorce is a pretty close second. That really fucking sucked. And my poor older son, and I was just surrounded, you guys. And I remember calling my Al-Anon sponsor, who also had 30 years of sobriety. And she said to me, Annette, you are in so much trouble. You are going to drink. And so I walked in this door right here to this room in June of 2022 on fire. If you sat next to me, I was on fire. I took my stuff. My book is here. I mean, I still sit like that. But I mean, they do not sit next to me. Do not talk to me. And I would just sit in meetings and sob. And I would try to go back to my parent groups, you guys. I would try. And I couldn't, because some newcomer would come in and be like, you know, my son smoked marijuana. And I can't take it. And I'm like, last night my son took a knife and cut every mole off his body because aliens had invaded him. Wow. So no, you want to talk about not feeling like you can relate to anybody? Nobody has my problem. I'm alone. And I'm filled with hatred. How dare that man abandon his kid? How dare he? How dare God do this to me? How can I deal with these feelings? And that's when I remembered these rooms. The only time I felt okay was coming into a meeting. And thank God for the 5 o'clock meetings here, because that's when I like to drink. I like to start drinking around 3, but 5, I'll wait till 5 if I have to. And they're all book studies. And I got back into those books, you know, so when it comes to, you know, number 4, the AA tools that help keep me sober, meetings, my sponsor, the one that I had when I first got sober in 2014, about a year into my sobriety, she got cancer, so she was dealing with her own things. And then 2 years into my sobriety is when my son got sick, and I just was completely obsessed with that. So I had to get a new sponsor. And I found this woman in that room next door, you guys. Yeah.
How can you love someone that much? I don't even know this woman. But everything about me is screaming help. And she just looks over and sees me. You wouldn't believe the stuff we have in common. You just wouldn't even believe it. She's a Pisces. I love her. And she took me through the steps and she made me follow the rules. She made me write my part. She made me see the insanity. Now, I live with an insane person, right? I have conservatorship over my son. He gets SSI. I'm his, I get 10 hours a week. I get paid for to be his caregiver. I had to do all that. I had to advocate for every single piece of him. Nobody gave us the medicine he needed. 9, 10, 11 medicines. So many hospitalizations, you guys. I've been popped in the face. I've been knocked down my stairs. He is doing great today. Okay. And I advocated my ass off for that kid. I can't do any of that unless I got a sponsor, unless I surrounded myself with women. The things that were missing off this list are number four for me. Number one was gratitude. My gratitude list every day. I'm just grateful for my coffee. I'm just grateful. Like it, you know, I like blueberries. I mean, I had to start off really small, you know. Present moment awareness belongs on my list. That's what I'm doing when I'm praying and meditating. I am so scared of the future. The future is too scary. When you're a caregiver of a very sick person, the future is terrifying. I'm not allowed to go there. It's a dubious luxury of normal men. Even though I'm a good man, I'm not allowed to go there. Okay. I'm not allowed to time travel back either. I was a drunk mom. I didn't get sober till my kids were 12 and 14. Okay. And I still drove, you know, they went camping. They had a Jeep with a gun too. You know, what else belongs in my list? Nature. I have to walk. It is an integral part of my sobriety. If I do not get outside and walk, I am not okay. I need to get on my bike. I have to. It's not an aside. I have to. That's where my church is. Period. I need projects that give me creative joy. I have 50 houseplants. I do all this stuff with rocks. Like I make bracelets. I got to stay busy, right? I need positive content. When my son first got sick, I was watching every horror movie that I'd never seen. Every single one. Oh, and if you want to really watch some screwed up shit, Hoarders.
Oh,
I was watching Hoarders and Saw 1, 2, and 3. And it was amazing because nothing could scare me anymore. But you know what? That had to go. I need positive content as a part of my sobriety. I have completely edited my social media. You start talking about politics on my page, I don't follow you anymore. You start posting all your victim bullshit, I don't follow you anymore. I curate my feed. I can't have it, you guys. My nervous system gets disrupted. It is an integral part of my sobriety to control my content. And I have to write. I have to write. You saw me writing. I sit up here. I write. I write down what you say. I have some hilarious. You guys are hilarious. I write down what you say. And if I want to cheer myself up. Oh my God. I have stuff written in these books of things people have said in meetings that are so amazing. I'm going to make a coffee table book all about y'all. I have to write. I need projects. I need nature. I need movement. And yeah. Yeah. I sponsor 4 women. Yeah. Yeah. I read my literature. I have a very strong morning routine. I'm tight. I'm tight with my morning. How much time do I have? All right. I have a very tight morning routine. And if I don't do it in the morning, I have a thing that I call midday mindfulness. If I don't get everything done, I eat at lunch. So I'll finish up one of my daily readers. If I haven't done my gratitude list that day, I do it. I have to. My son takes medication 4 times a day. Four times a day. He takes five different things. Guess who's in charge of the medication? What, do I not need medication? What am I doing to treat myself? Being a caregiver is detrimental on people's health. It is not an opinion. It's been proven. I am not a victim. I am not a victim. My son got diagnosed with an incurable mental illness. He will never have a girlfriend. He will never. I had to mourn the death of a dream. That's what happens when you lose somebody. This disease follows us to the gates of insanity or death. I got the insanity. And if I ever wanted to be a victim, I'll tell you one little part. This is the non-casserole illness. Nobody was there for me. I couldn't make dinner. I couldn't get out of bed. And nobody came. And you know why? Because I didn't have a strong fellowship here. He got diagnosed in February. I didn't come back here till June. You guys, if I would have been here with you guys, you would have fed me.
Yeah.
You would have come. You would have helped me. I cheated myself out of that. I'll never do that again. You will get what you need in these rooms. It won't look the way that I wrote it out, but you will get what you need in these rooms. I can't believe the women I've met. I can't believe the man I met. I can't believe it. I've been overpaid. And you know what? I didn't cause my son's mental illness. I cannot control it. I cannot cure it. My son came in with it. He came in with it. It was in him. I am responsible for what's in front of me. I am not a victim of it. Would I trade everything I've learned to get my son's brain back? Probably. But you guys, to pretend that I didn't grow and learn from that is a lie. To pretend that I didn't get things that I never even knew I wanted would not be inaccurate. He helped me become the person that God wants me to be.
Yeah.
It's just like what Jenny read. I am supposed to take care of my son. And today I'm not. I've been a teacher of my fitness for 37 years. I'm a student. I have a life that I'm a student. And I just need to show up. I need to take the right action in the day I'm in. He takes his pills. I take my vitamins. I clean his room. I clean my room. I take him to a doctor's appointment. I go to a meeting. I take him to therapy. I go to therapy. I show up for people. You can count on me. I'm responsible. And if I have to go and be by myself or go to a woman's retreat, and someone's like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I was riding my bike. Where are those flowers? You took a great picture of the flowers. Where is that? I'm like, you can't go. It's 16 miles in. You cannot get there by car. You can, if you have a motorcycle, you can. And I'm allowed. I'm allowed to ride my bike in the middle of nowhere and say, I'm so grateful today that I have legs at work that ride me. My older son goes to therapy. He doesn't drink to solve the problems he has with his dad and in his life. He goes to therapy too. And I am able to be an example, not just for, and you want to, and I'll close with this. I never have to feel guilty about being that drunk mom, because I literally make living amends.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know I was going to get so much out of it. I didn't know. And so when it talks about the AA tools that helped me stay sober, helping others. And I just really appreciate you guys. It was hard for me to talk about that. But we can stay sober.
Yeah.
And be recovered. So. Thanks for listening.
Okay. Last but not least, our next speaker is going to be Norm.
Hey, Norm.
Can you have some mic down, Benny?
I got to blow my nose.
My name is Norm, and I am an alcoholic, and I'm also a drug addict. Much like, I guess, most, well, I didn't have, when I was growing up, my dad didn't have a Jeep with a shotgun in it, but I grew up with Ozzie and Harriet as my mother and father, and it was a good, I had a great childhood. I lived in a nice suburb north of Chicago and had everything that I wanted. I would get my quarter a week allowance. It went a long way back then. My sobriety date, by the way, is 1/1/99. I haven't had a drink or a drug this particular century. But growing up, I always had fear. What did I fear? I didn't fear riding on a saucer, being pulled by a car in the snow. No fear of that. I didn't have a fear of waiting on a corner and when the bus went by, grabbing the back of it, we called it skitching, and skitching to school. I didn't have a fear of skiing from a big mountain. But what I had a fear of was girls. I had a girlfriend. It took me about 8 to 10 months before I even admitted that she was my girlfriend, because girls always scared me, because I always wanted the prettiest girl, and the prettiest girl always had a boyfriend, so I couldn't get that pretty girl as my girlfriend. So at any rate, I grew up in this lovely suburb. My parents didn't drink except socially. Though later on, after I became sober, looking back on my childhood, I believe my mother was an alcoholic. Mainly because she couldn't wait for a friend of my dad's who we called Uncle Bob to come to the house because he liked to have cocktails before dinner. And my mom just would be excited at when he was going to come. And so I think, and I don't know what she did later on in my story. I went to college. I started off at University of Colorado, where I was introduced to substances. I was introduced to VO, which I had a real taste for. I was introduced to pot. And I was introduced to being away from home at 17. And so what I had and my college was paid by my parents. And I had a one-year vacation in Colorado. I skied at least 4 days a week. I'd get loaded on weekends. And at the end of my freshman year, University of Colorado said, "Don't come back." And so I didn't come back. And instead, there I was in Winnetka, Illinois. But luckily, my best friend, who had gone to Northern Illinois University, was told the same thing by that university. So he and I were in Winnetka. We were the studs of the suburbs because we were older. And so the girls would come. And we were also introduced at that time to our first dope dealer. We also, I don't know if anybody here liked, what was the name of that wine? It was this wine that my best friend always said it had helium in it.
What?
Because you drink it and your head would explode. And we used to drink that wine. We'd buy six bottles of it, and there'd be about eight of us, and we'd go through those six bottles. I didn't particularly like alcohol, though, but what I liked was where it put me. My grand sponsor, may he rest in peace, Ted S., used to say, it got me there, and we all know where there is. The only problem I had with alcohol was that by the time I got there, I had already had four more drinks. And so I would pass out. I remember one time I wound up in Memphis, Tennessee, because I had passed out in my best friend's back seat, and he decided that that's where we were going to go. And I woke up there. And it was the 4th of July, and it was about 109. I don't know why we were there. Our friends had all gone to Michigan, which made sense, but there we were in Memphis. So at any rate, I went back to school, little school in Iowa, and I'm kind of glad I did because we had small classes, great professors. It's a very good school. And I graduated from there in 1968. And if any of you are aware of what was going on in our country in 1968, well, I was part of it. I was very anti-war. I started two SDS chapters. That was Students for a Democratic Society that later became, there was a faction of it that became the Weathermen. And that's when I dropped out of there. I went down and I was accepted into law school. And I went down to the draft board and I showed them my law school acceptance. And they said, that's nice. You can start, but you ain't going to finish. And sure enough, I didn't start. I went to work for Sears. And 4 months later, I was drafted. After going through basic training, AIT, which was advanced infantry training, and armored personnel carrier training, I went over to Vietnam. And I actually didn't mind Vietnam. Because in Vietnam, they had cheap drink. You could buy a case of beer for a dollar. You could buy any drug that you wanted. And you could buy any little girl that you wanted. When I say little girls, because they only stood about that tall. They were called the Boom Boom Girls. There was, and I stayed absolutely fucked up for the 13 months I was in Vietnam. I didn't like getting shot at. I picked up two Purple Hearts and a Bronze Star while I was there. The only reason I got that stuff, by the way, was because I was loaded. Because if I hadn't been, I would have been hiding. You know, I mean, it's like, I always had this thing, and pardon me if any of you are offended by this, but they always gave the Congressional Medal of Honor to somebody who jumped on a grenade and saved their fellows. Well, you got to be nuts to jump on a grenade. But then once you've been there and in it, you realize that that guy who won the Congressional Medal of Honor was the smallest man in the unit, and he was thrown on that grenade. I hate to burst everybody's bubble, but at any rate, I came home from Vietnam, and I had kind of changed my direction while I was there. My brother-in-law was a professor at University of Nebraska, and he arranged for me to get an assistantship and a fellowship to University of Nebraska Business School, where I was going to go and get my MBA and go out and be a millionaire. And unfortunately, when I got home, 3 days after I got home, I had to take the business grad school admission test. And I walked out of that test. My best friend was waiting for me because we were going to go east. I walked out of that test. I threw my suitcase in the car. And I said, they've changed the entire economic system since I was in college. And I scored the lowest on that test of any one of those kind of tests I ever took. And, of course, there went my assistantship and my fellowship. So we went to the East, took a trip, saw friends in Boston, friends in New York. When I was in New York, I had the great experience of shooting up dope with James Taylor. I met Jim there. And then we went to Boston, and our friends who were there went through all of our drugs. So we had to go home. And we went up to Canada on the way home to get a sitar that our friend had left there. Came back down, and coming through customs, they found marijuana seeds on the floor of the car. They took our names, they took our pictures, and they said, never come back to Canada again. So then I was banned from Canada, which wouldn't allow me to go to the world meeting. So I couldn't go there because it was in Canada. So at any rate, we then went down to Florida. Got a place down there. We were down in Key West, where in the morning we would get up and look at the sunrise. And in the afternoon, we'd go to the other side of it and watch the sunset, which is a wonderful thing to do on acid. In the meanwhile, we were drinking. My friend liked to drink beer, and he would go through beer. I mean, he would go through a case and a half in a night. I, on the other hand, like scotch. And so I would be drinking scotch. And, you know, and back then there were these, you don't see them anymore because I think they banned them, were barbiturates. Secanol, Nembutal, Tuinol, rainbows, reds, and yellows. And so drinking what we did and popping a couple of those really got you there. In fact, it got you above there. And that's what we were doing. And my best friend went back to Chicago for Thanksgiving. He came back down. We decided it was time to move back up. So we went back up to Chicago. And mind you, I had never been in cold weather since I had left to go in the Army. I did my training down in Louisiana, and then I went to Kentucky. Then I went to Washington in the summer, and I went over to Vietnam, and it was in June. When I came home, it was in July. Well, at any rate, I came home in July, and then went to Boston. It was summertime. We went down to Florida. I came up to Chicago, and I could not stand the cold. It was 22 below. And so I said, nope, I loaded up my Volkswagen station wagon with all my belongings, which tells you how much I had, and my dog, and I drove to California. And I came out here, and I thought, now that I'm out here, I'm going to go to law school. I'd been accepted at Hastings. I went up there, and they said, we'll take you, but you have to wait until next September. My sister was in law school down in Los Angeles here, and so she said, why don't you come here? So I went there, and I got in. And I thought, now I won't die from eating downers and drinking. I'm in a new place. I can just stop doing that. But you know what? I didn't want to.
Yeah.
I liked being loaded. I liked being high. For one thing, now I could go up to that prettiest girl and say, do you want to dance? Why don't we go home? And I'd even sometimes get to go to their house. But I quickly found the same thing here that I had found there. And that was druggies and drunks. And that's who I started hanging out with. I did make it through law school. I got my law degree. I was admitted to the bar, though they held me up for 22 months because of my nefarious past. The fact that I had been convicted of possession of cocaine for sale, that kind of made them wonder. But I got in and I became a criminal lawyer. Not me being a criminal, the people I represented. In fact, I've run into some past clients in AA. But I became a criminal lawyer and I became a good one. I was taught by one of the best. And I used to get these phone calls, middle of the night. Norm, I just got busted for driving under the influence. They've got me here at the jail. I say, well, why don't you sleep it off? They'll let you out tomorrow and go to an AA meeting and start going to AA meetings and get a card signed or a piece of paper. I had never been to an AA meeting. I had no idea what an AA meeting was like. I only knew that I could show that piece of paper to the prosecutor and say, my client knew he had a problem. What kind of deal can we make? And I was very successful at that. And I, you know, and that ran to all kinds of different things, like when somebody would get busted for drugs, possession, not sales, but possession, I'd say, go to NA. Start getting those signatures. I'd never been to an NA meeting or a CA meeting for that matter. And then came the time when all of a sudden it wasn't feeling good anymore. I was now 52 years old and it wasn't feeling good. And I was at a friend's house on New Year's Eve, 1998. And I was loaded. And we ran out of stuff, and this girl that I had been seeing on the side, though I was married, she said, I'll go get some more. And I turned to my friend after she left. It was 10:45. I'll never forget that. And I said, I can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. I said, it's no fun anymore. And I went home. And that was the last night I got loaded. Now, we talk about staying sober during life's changes.
Okay.
Yeah, I got sober. Like I say, on the 1st of January, 1999, I walked in. I had been going to meetings starting in April of 98. Why? Because in April of 98, I got lucid for 2 days. And I said, I'm in trouble. I had taken $92,000 that didn't belong to me. And this girl I was seeing, she and I went through it in about 2 weeks. Yeah. And I said, I can't do this. And so I called my friend Frank, Frank H., if anybody remembers him. If you remember the no smoking lawsuit that was brought at Rafters, he did it. And I said, I need help. And Frank said, well, come on over. He gave me a big book. He gave me a 12 and 12 and started taking me to meetings. And we went through the book. We got about halfway through. But I wasn't ready yet. He was disabled, couldn't drive, so I had to be the one who drove. And I'd drop him off. I'd open this little drawer. I had a Honda and had this little drawer on the side. And in there would be 5 or 6 rocks. And I'd smoke them on the way home. And this is what I did from April of 1998 until January 1st of 99. So I didn't go out because I never came in. I mean, that's the way I've always looked at it. I never strung 3 days straight during that period of time. But on January the 1st, 1999, I finally found the fellowship, because these people that I knew, that I was going to the men's stag, and these men who knew me, because now I'd been going for 4 or 5, however many months that is, and Jimmy C, when I stood up, when I was driving to that meeting, I said, am I going to have the honesty to admit to all of these men that I'm a newcomer? And when the leader said, is there anybody here in their first 30 days? I stood up and I said, I'm Norm and I'm an alcoholic. And Jimmy C turned around. I was sitting right in back of him, and he turned around and he said, I'll talk to you at the break. And he became my sponsor. And Jimmy took me through the steps. I remember doing third step prayer in his cupola that he had behind his house. And many, many, many men I know have done the same thing, because Jimmy loved to sponsor newcomers. By the time you get to be 2 or 3, Jimmy's not so interested. But when, because that's when he stops returning your calls. So I was 3. When I had 3 years, I got a new sponsor, and I'm looking at his stone up there, Lee P. Mm. We used to call him Reverend Lee, because he was a minister, sort of. He was a mail order minister. He was here in Santa Clarita, and he did preach, and he had a church. And I went through the steps again with Lee, and Lee and I became not so much sponsor and sponsee as we became friends. And when he had problems, he would call me. And when I had problems, I would call him. which now leads me to staying sober during life changes. Bad things happen when you're sober. Bad things happen when you're not sober. But when you're sober, bad things happen. What was the first thing? The first thing for me was losing my law license. State Bar took it away in 2000. I had 18 months of sobriety. And when they, I was wrong, by the way, when I told you before, when they took it away from me, I got a call from Tommy Summers. Ted had testified for me. Lee testified for me. A bunch of people testified for me when I was going through the hearing with my license. But I lost it, and Tommy called me, and he said, "I'm glad." And I said, "What do you mean you're glad? I thought we were friends." And he says, "No, I'm glad you could accept it." Yeah. And that's the first time that I learned what it meant, the word acceptance. I have no power over what is going on out there. I have no power over any of you. The only thing I have power over is me. I'm the only one who can change me, and I can't change any of you. My best friend was a poly drug user, just like I was. Whatever was around that would get us high, we would take. He got married on my 8th anniversary. My wife and I went to his wedding back in Chicago. And he married this woman who had 2 daughters, and he wanted to adopt them. And they said, "No, we don't want to be adopted by a drunk." So he went to Sierra Tucson. I don't know if that's where you were referring to in Tucson, but he went to Sierra Tucson, and he went through their program, and he got clean and sober. Went on to school to get his master's in counseling. But I didn't. I didn't get clean and sober then. That was before 1999. But in 1999, or 1998 rather, my wife called him. He was living up in Washington. And she said, "Will you come down and help Norman? He's in a lot of trouble." She knew that I was doing crack cocaine, but she was also worried because when I would come home after 3 or 4 days of being away, I would drink like a fish. Why? Because I wanted to come down. But I also liked the feeling it gave me versus the feeling that I had. And she called him, and he came down here to LA, and we went out on a drive, and he said, "What's the problem?" And I said, "Well, the problem is this girl I've been seeing. I'm just going to stop seeing her and I'll be fine." And being my best friend, he said, "Okay." And he went back up to Seattle. I think my wife was expecting him to do an intervention on me, but he didn't. So at any rate, they took away my license in 2000. I'll go back to there. And I learned acceptance. A few years later, in 1995, my wife and I were going to move to Oregon. I had taken the bar there. I had passed the bar there. We were in a contract to buy a house up there. And the day before we were supposed to close, I wound up in the hospital needing emergency back surgery. Well, my income went from here to here because now all I had was disability. And so moving to Oregon was out of the question, except we were now homeless because we had sold the house. We had nowhere to live. So we moved into a house in Westlake, or whatever it is, the eastern end of the valley. And we were there for a couple of years. I was still getting loaded. This was in 1995. In 2004, I had more back surgery, and I got laid off my job all in the same time, and my best friend died all in 2004. How did I handle that? I accepted. I also had a lot of men that came around and helped me. They came to my house and put on meetings for me. And when I was able to get back to meetings, they would help me up the stairs at Rafters. So I really found the fellowship. And then my sister died, leaving me as the only remaining good friend. My wife and I did not have kids. My wife stayed with me, by the way, through all of this. And in August, we'll be celebrating our 50th anniversary. Much about the same time you'll be celebrating your 50th birthday. And so I rely, what keeps me sober through all these life's changes? Staying very close to the fellowship, going to meetings, praying, because I know that my God loves me. And I know that my God only wants good for me. And when he puts these tests in front of me, he knows that I can pass them. Why? Because I have a very spiritual life. I believe very strongly in my higher power. I turn to my higher power for more things. Just recently, I lost my best friend in AA. And I accepted it. And I've tried to help his wife through this. And I hope his wife becomes able to accept that God had his plan and God needed Jim next to him. Because that's the way it is. We have no power. I have cancer, but right now is in remission. It's liver cancer. I don't know if it will stay in remission. You know, and 4 years ago, if I'd had it, I'd be dead. But they've developed these, scientists have developed these treatments, and it's amazing. But you know what? My friend Spencer Schramm, we were walking out of a meeting, and I said to him, it was where the topic had been fear, and we walked out, and Spencer said, I have no fear. And I said, what are you talking about, Spencer? How can you have no fear? He had been diagnosed with lung cancer. He had lung cancer. He had no fear. I have liver cancer. I have no fear. There is now nothing that I fear. Yeah, I don't like snakes, but I don't fear them. I don't fear what's going to happen because I live right now. All I have is right now in this room at this moment. And I hope all of you have this now in this moment, especially our two newcomers. Welcome to both of you. And I hope you guys stay because that's the only way that you will live the miracle that the rest of us are. Thank you.
Okay. So now we are going to open for a Q&A session. Hi, Chris Alcoholic, by the way. I wanted to open it up for any newcomers in the room, if you guys would like to share.
I'm Nick. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Nick.
This isn't my first crack at sobriety, but I've heard from all of you up there. Thank you all for your shares. It's that one time where things just kind of click, and I don't think I've ever truly surrendered. I've been embarrassed to be an alcoholic, and this last time, I was only out for maybe 3 weeks, but 3 weeks I was able to bring myself to my knees with alcohol by the grace of God and get back to these rooms. I've never been to a workshop like this. I've never been to a alcohol or anything, but that was my other choice today. And I'm just diving head first. I got a great sponsor. So, thank you.
To the other newcomer in
Julia. Yeah, I'm Jerianne, and I'm a big fat alcoholic.
Hello.
Hi, Jerianne.
Hey, everybody. Thank you, Norman, of course. Thank you for everything. Thank you. Yeah, my husband, Jimby, just died. His stone's up there. And unexpectedly, and I lived my life with him. He would go to meetings, and he had a sponsor, so I just lived vicariously through him, you know? Didn't stay clean and sober, stopped the alcohol, but it was the other clean part that I had a problem with. I could talk a doctor into giving me anything I needed, or wanted, I should say. And that was my story. And so now that Jim has passed and it's just me, I turn myself to face myself. I guess that's in that song, whatever. And I don't like what I see. I'm sorry. It's my phone. I apologize. I don't do enough meetings. You know, I have the love and support of the program, but I'd rather sit at home and cry and feel sorry for myself, you know, instead of letting all of you know what's really going on inside my heart and acceptance. No, I'm sorry. I don't accept that he's dead. He shouldn't be dead. He should be right here with me. And that's me being a spoiled, rotten, brat, stubborn person. All of my lovely character defects. And the drugs don't work, you know, they just don't work. I know that in my heart of hearts, I can't believe I'm saying, gonna say it out loud, 29 days clean and sober today. It's a miracle, because I can talk myself into anything. And if I want the love around me to help me through this and my family, and I have to stay clean and sober, or they're going to be gone as the wind, you know, with the wind. They won't help me in any way. And the clearer I stay day to day, the more I'm not that bad, you know, I always, you don't have the hammer. Oh, you should do this, should. It's not that bad now that I'm thinking clearly. It's really, I'm not that bad, you know? So thank you, Norman, for inviting me to this long meeting. Normal, you know, time, hour and a half. But God knows what I need, and I guess Norman does too. So I'm glad I'm here, and I'm glad you guys are here. And thanks for being here, all of you, you crazy people.
Yep.
Because I'm crazy too. And one day at a time.
Yeah.
This day, I'm not going to drink or use.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty safe today. And then tomorrow's going to be another day. And I should do this again because, wow, I feel better. I was laughing. I was actually laughing during the meeting. Amazing. Thank you all again for letting me share and letting me come.
Are there any other newcomers who would like to share?
Denise, alcoholic. Denise, I'm on like 33 days. All of you speakers, you guys are so inspirational and have given me so much to think about when I'm having a hard time taking direction from my sponsor. Mm-hmm. We just kind of had a little get together yesterday where she was mad at me. I took a 30-day chip. I guess I didn't say the right things. And got on me, but then also shared about it in the meeting, which just pissed me off even more. So they have a thing where they all go up to her house and we talked about it and everything's good. But it's me having a hard time taking direction and listening to you guys and hearing y'all had the same. And you've all been through some horrific stuff in sobriety and you're still sober. Yeah. That gives me so much hope, and I have been looking so hard for hope because it's not my first time. I've been doing this since 1993, mm-hmm. and I've never made it more than 90 days.
Yeah.
And the last time I was back was just about a year and a half ago, and I've been having a real hard time because I'm reading things I said then, and they're exactly the same as the way I know now, mm-hmm. and it's scary that maybe I am not as committed as I thought I was, but I am. And you guys just sent that inspiration through the roof. And I thank you so much for being here and doing that for me.
Thank you. Hey, anyone else?
Thank you. My name is Dwayne. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dwayne.
Been to the Rafters a couple times a couple years back. You know, I had a good experience, got a few chips there. decided that I got to speed. I got my DMPs. I've been drinking since I was 13. I'm Canadian. I'm in bars. You know, dad's German, mom's Native American. That's a recipe for alcoholism and diabetes. Yay. Jack Pockmaner. But through the process, I've never stopped drinking for about 4 years ago where I said I had the 6 months clean. Oh, no, sorry, my three years ago, right? 6 months clean. Mm-hmm. I got the speed, take the demon, take the drink, and the drink takes the man or not the alcohol. And I said, well, went to like a weekend bender. I'm like, okay, demon's still there. I got the speed. Another 6 months, slam dunk. And then life changes happen, lose a job. Boom. Very lucrative job that would have taken maybe 3 years closer to my retirement.
Yeah.
Boom. I'm good in the industry. I'm a manufacturing executive. I'm good at what I do. I've been coached throughout my years to enjoy the libations. That's how we bring the clients, and that's how you do these things, right? But time and time again, I need a drink. Why? I just shut down three factories. I just shut down 1,000 people, right? Dwayne, got a drink, get it over. Anybody, pick your kid back. And you do that enough times, and after a while, it's like all of a sudden you start seeing the effects at home and everything else, right? And it said, then I went into AA again a couple times. And unfortunately, I am a proud atheist. And there is, for my mind's eye, there is no divinity. There is only the void. There is nothing. Okay. And if there is divinity, he is the book of Job, and he's the Sodom and Gomorrah, and he's a malicious one, right? But that's part of it. What we talked about, what I've caught over the last couple of days, was the the anger of everything that we all have. We're just trying to shoot it up. That person, you know, I can just, you know, do that judging, right? So hit a bad patch, you know, just lost another extremely lucrative job this past about 3 months ago. Went on a 3 month bender. Then I blinked up. I said, this is not good, right? You know, and then I'm kicking into the funds. The kids are gone, you know, and I can, and just like scheduling and everything else. Okay, I got the kids at school 7:30. I don't got to pick them up till 5 because they got practice. I got a good 6 hours before I have to sober up, that kind of stuff. I'm doing my math in my head at that. And then I tried another chapter at AA, and I just kept getting an onslaught with, you've got to convert. You've got to believe everywhere. There is no higher power but me. The universe lives and dies by me. It doesn't exist before, it doesn't exist after me, and prove me wrong, right? But of course, it's purely ego, right? You know, kind of stuff, just because it's the anger, right? Because, you know, growing up, when dad died young, mom's an alcoholic, the whole family's an alcoholic. So when I decided on Friday, I came to the, now I think it was called, I said, I got to get out of this. I'm having an urge. I'm going to crack that whole bottle of whiskey. I'm going to finish it. So I came to the, I think it was called Living in the Now on Friday morning. First meeting, probably an extremely long time. First time at this chapter. And wow, did I feel so welcome. I never saw so many people welcome me and without, you know, just, you know, trying to convert me and just coming, oh, you're sponsored. Oh, you're sponsored. Oh, you're sponsored. Down, right? Kind of settle down there. Yeah, I'm Steph Thorne's making sure this, you know, not gonna get shanked in the back or something like that. I saw everyone was so welcoming and everyone, and then I'm at the point where I was even, I don't want AA, right? ChatGPT, generate me an AA program, take out the divinity, replace it with stoicism, you know, all these stoicism. The program, right? But it really forces me to become self-isolated, which I've been over the last couple of years, right? I don't want to talk to family, don't want to talk to relatives. I don't want to know. I'm the big guy who runs the factories and stuff like that. I'm always on, right? I don't want to talk to anybody right now, right? But I'm because I'm jobless too, it makes it easier. So I'm at home, I'm self-isolated, I'm day drinking this and that, pick up the kids, evening drinking or hitting the weed or whatever I got to do, right? Then I hit on a Ozempic, I'll finish up, I'm on a Ozempic, you know, and wow, you don't eat, so I'm dropping pounds, I dropped like 80, 90 pounds, and then wow, you know, if you drink on Ozempic, it is so fast, and it's like, and then it's, okay, but I got to go volume here, I had to ruin my gastric bypass. I got to lower it. I got to switch to IV and heart liquor. I can't do that past stuff anymore. So I'm doing all these mental gymnastics here. But when I came here yesterday and I came here this morning, 9 o'clock here today. And since I'm unemployed, I got lost free time. So the idea of that was really what I'm seeing here is the fellowship was really what I was missing. That's what I was missing in all the other areas because I want to self-isolate. I don't want people to judge me, people to think differently of me, and purely pride and ego. And being here for my third meeting or second meeting plus my first workshop, just letting you guys know, you guys are absolutely amazing. I am so inspired. Yeah. Last night, I went home and I looked at the rafters, the Al-Anon, and I think there's one up in Saugus, whatever they call it. They're not Saugus, Canyon Country. And I hit up every single my Google calendar on the meetings I want to do, which ones fit in the schedules and everything else. So I think I'm booked for like 60 hours a week. So I got to drop that out. Thank you, everyone. I was really inspired. The concept of fellowship was the exact, if there is a higher power, maybe this is it. I don't believe in it. But I also believe that when I threw that gun in my head, you know, about 2 months ago and it misfired. And I threw that other, and I got mad, and I said, screw you. I grabbed the other gun, threw it in my head, misfired. I said, all right, if there's a sign, all right, I'll go and check this stuff up. Yeah. All right, and here we are. So thank you guys.
Yay! Welcome.
It's not on travel rewards cards.
You don't have to drink. Okay, is there anybody else who has something to share? It's open Q&A session. Everyone just is squirrely and wants to get out of their chair. Look at you guys back there. Yeah, anybody?
I'm Tiffany, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm in the 6th month in this program, and this is my first workshop also, and it's thank you for all of your shares. Annette, I love you so much, and I find you so inspiring.
I love you too.
I feel like very overwhelmed with like where I'm at in sobriety. Like I have to be focused in my program, in my meetings, making myself like, not making myself, but being told and like where my life is changing right now. I've just fully immersed myself in this program. When I came in, I thought I knew God. God is a punishing God, but now I seek like my higher power outside of being in nature. My story had a lot of grief in it before I came in. My partner also passed away, and I'm just healing. I'm on this healing journey right now, just figuring out who I am, figuring out the inside and trying to heal it and trying to be okay with what's happening today, right? Not like future tripping and not trying to predict what's going to happen in the future. But I just stay fully immersed in this program. I have an amazing sponsor who, like, she's like my second mom. Like, I go to really everything, and I'm just grateful for this program. And this room continues to save my life every day. I have really close connections and relationships with people in this program, and I think that's all I have today. And this workshop was great, and I'm glad I was able to make it, because usually on Saturdays I spend time with my son, and I have to get going here in a little bit, but I just wanted to share and thank you guys for your share. Okay.
Who's your alcoholic?
Richard.
I'm still recovering from myself. I remember you before. We've been here two dozen times. My schedule was flexible, worked in the film business, so I had night calls, day calls, and movies. So I come here, and I remember you, especially, because I'm a month behind February 27, 2004. And I think you had probably been here once or twice just listening to you. And, it's so funny, but you were talking about just yourself and your big personality, because you remind me of my ex-girlfriend. She was from New Hampshire, and she was just loud and fast and just driving nuts. And she was in the front. when I was listening to her, I was like, there it is. And when I first, started going out with her, all of her family, it would come up to me and say, she's a lot. All of them. I'm like, okay, get it. A couple. But when there's like 10, 12 of them, tell me it's not a little great channel. But, it lasted so long, we were flying back and forth. And, because I had lost my wife in 2019. And then, 2 years later, I lose my youngest son at 27.
Oh.
And then a year later, I lose my mom. But through all that, I still kept it together. Right now I'm in the area that I keep telling myself I'm still trying to live without my wife, because we were together all 42 years. Mm-hmm. We were when she was 12. It took me 7, 8 years to finally wear her down when she went out with But and it worked. When those things were happening, I'm thinking, it's ridiculous. God's supposed to be taking care of me. I've been taking care of myself. But I got it. And the more I say, the more I learn. And, it was ironic. My son, he dropped dead, literally. He had a ulcer in his stomach and ate through a main artery. And so we were doing phone tag real quick. But I called my mom, who was my rock. And she raised, 5 brothers and 2 sisters. 4 of them in prison, 2 of them died, they're mafia, so she was a hard woman. But when I called her about her grandson, she let out a yell that I had never heard before in my life, ever. I was scared because I knew how she felt. But I'm getting through it, all of it, and still doing more commitments. I have my meetings and doing GSR work now following our member that passed away. And you know, I'm committees, go to church with the grandkids because they still like me, spend some time with them. You know, so I got 7 grandkids now, and it's a lot of work. You know, but, you know, having given the tools here and working with people, especially Jeff, I love Jeff. Man, he's full of answers. I can always go to him. Mm-hmm. But thankful that he's here.
I have a question.
Yeah?
Carissa, alcoholic.
Hey, Carissa.
Maybe this would be for an hour, Jenny. Either one of you can answer. Okay. So thank you for sharing your experience, Strength and Hope. I got to hear deeper parts of your stories. But I'm curious how you handle a situation where, you know, you have kids or you're a full-time caretaker, right? Like, how do you even inventory your life and your program of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to, you know, make sure you're consistently getting to meetings and not leaving AA to the side, but also being there for the people that deserve your presence? Like, how do you do that? Do you, like, do you pick up the phone and go, hey, sponsor, like, this is all my shit. Like, what are we going to do about this?
Jenny Alcoholic, I'll answer that, and then Annette should pitch in too. I had learned early on that absolutely everything comes after my relationship with God, number one. Number two, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything comes after that. Because if I don't take care of those two parts of my life and program, I'm of no use to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I have a check-in call every week with my sponsor. I see her regularly also at meetings, and then we meet once a month as well. So I'm very current with her. That's like third on the list, is having that relationship with my sponsor. And then it's just, you know, I have to make sure when I retire at night and I take a look at, you know, was I selfish? Did I have self-seeking motives? Was I of maximum service? You know, where can I do better? If I can take that quick assessment at night and say, you had a good day, you know, then I can fall asleep. And it's rinse and repeat. It's not rocket science, right? You know, that's how I conduct myself. I have to, or I'll end up back at BevMo.
If my son doesn't take his medication,
yeah,
he can't function at all, at all. You know, and it's so scary because, you know, if you get into like apocalyptic thinking, I've like wanted to hoard the medication and try to save it. But, you know, he can only do it in the day he's in, and we can only do it in the day we're in. And like what Jenny said, we cannot pour from empty cups.
Yeah.
And we're self-discipline for an alcoholic. We're undisciplined. It was like Steve said something. He goes, I'm just trying to find the easier way to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And that's my, like, you know, when you were saying surrender is not your natural state, being lazy, self-centered, and taking easy street is my natural state. And so it takes self-discipline. You know, it took me 10 years into sobriety before I started reading page 84 and 85 every day. And what you said killed me, like to go to ChatGPT and say, take out God and become a stoic. But there is something about stoicism that alcoholics can learn from, and it's the power of asking questions. And what Jenny was just saying is key. You know, it's like, you know, I have a sponsee, and every time I talk to her, she's like, I just am so depressed, and I feel like absolute shit, and la, la, la. And I go, did you take a walk? Did you go to a meeting? Did you eat breakfast? Did you sleep? You know, and at some point, it's like, if you want to go complain, like, you got the wrong sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go to Victims Anonymous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm part of Action Anonymous.
Yeah.
Like, don't complain to me about not getting results from some, I'm not talking about you, but like this fine case. Like, not you. But, like, if someone's complaining about, what does Pat always say? I'll talk in a general sense. If someone's complaining that they didn't get results from something they didn't do, to me, that's a step two problem. Mm-hmm. They're insane. Yeah. They're insane. That's insane. I didn't do anything and I didn't get what I wanted. And they're looking you dead in the eye like, why isn't that working? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, but we all have those curious mental blind spots. But as far as like, you know, just one day at a time. And if I skip one day, I just have to get back to it the next. And it is, it's a juggling act. It's balance.
Yeah.
It really is. If I go to a meeting, I'm going to miss this. If I go to, you know, that, if something happens, like he went into psychosis yesterday for 3 hours and I really wanted to go on a bike ride.
Mm.
But when he goes into psychosis, my son's eyes roll back in his head and he walks around the house like this and I'm scared he's going to fall in the pool. Now I can sit around and feel sorry for myself because I can't go on a bike ride, or I can put on a yoga video. Like, I can be a problem solver.
Mm-hmm.
I can call up a sponsee and be like, how are you? See how I am. Yeah. So it's just, you know, one day at a time and not skip twice. You know, if I skip meditation once, mm-hmm. I try not skip it the next day. And if I can't do 5 minutes, I do 1 minute. You know, and if I eat cookies because I was all stressed out about crying in front of you people, just eat blueberries tomorrow.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else have questions? No. What?
Just talk about for anyone on the panel, during your times, because a lot of you guys have quite a few amazing years of success, but sometimes you just, I'll either get it in the, you know, I got a bad day and I got 20 rejection letters and this and that, da, 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 or it's having a great day. Hey, after I left, actually, I had some recruiters, headhunters call me with amazing opportunities, right? I'm like, oh, there's something. Okay, well, but how do you guys dealt with that temptation when you say either on the low or the high, you're thinking, hey, I'm good. Like, how do you avoid that? You know, was it the man takes the drink and the drink takes the man? So how do you avoid that first one up? Like, what's helped you over the years and years? Because everyone's going to be different with tools and what you have available to you.
Steve, I think you should share.
I've gotten the advice. Interesting question. I've gotten the advice, you know, careful when things get good.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. I'll happily take the credit for it. But also, it takes some of the heat off, right? Like, I'm willing to do stuff I don't like when things are bad.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, things get pretty good. I get kind of comfortable. And, you know, that's why I use the phrase like window of opportunity. You know, when I'm miserable enough, I'm willing to do stuff that I find distasteful, you know, whatever that is. You know, as a kid, I remember not liking taking a bath, right? But, you know, if things are going okay, so I think, like, for me, I think personally, like, I probably got to watch out when things are going my way. I get the job I want. I get the promotion. Finally have enough money. Like, I can do whatever I want. And for me, that's probably, you know, the time to pay more attention. I think it's a little easier for me to be humble and all the rest of it when things are not going my way. So, I don't know. That not to say I'd rather go through a tough spot. I'd rather go through some good times. But, you know, I don't know. That's kind of the sense I get.
Yeah, sometimes when you hear the newcomers coming in, you know, I've been drinking since 13. You hear the newcomers come in, so I've been 37. So I think you're fixed, you know, but you're still coming here, right? So I'm still trying to understand what temptations am I going to be dealing with the next, you know, 20 years or whatever I got.
No future tripping.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I'll tell you something. You lose the obsession. I don't even think about drinking. It doesn't even enter my mind. Taking a drug, it doesn't enter my mind because living sober is enough. Like last Friday night, I went and I saw a play that a friend that one of us is in over there in Newhall. And I walked in. My sponsor of mine had bought a ticket. So he and I, we walked in, and two seats were empty because two more guys from the fellowship were sitting there, and they had saved those seats for us. The one thing that all newcomers, maybe not all, but most newcomers think when they come in is, how am I ever going to have fun again if I can't drink, because there's just no fun? But you know what? We have a lot more fun sober, because when you're drinking, and I know from my personal experience, I went to California Jam back in whatever year that was, and I saw the Eagles, Black Sabbath,
all right,
just a bunch of people like that. And you know what? I didn't even remember seeing them because I was so loaded. Now, if I go, I went to a concert a month and a half ago. I saw Yes, even though they're not Yes, it's not the same Yes that I saw back in the day. But the lead guitar player is the same one. But I went there, and you know what? I'm talking about it now because I remember it, and that's where the fun comes in. The fun comes in from being able to remember what you did. When I was getting loaded, you know, I could have met the Queen of England, but the next day I wouldn't remember that that's what happened. Now I can't remember stuff, but that's just because I'm old. But, you know, that's the other thing, is the longer you stay here, the older you get. It's being sober. Jenny said it. Sobriety. My sobriety is number one.
Yeah.
It comes first. Because if I'm not sober, I'll lose everything I have now, because I lost everything I had when I was drinking and using. And that's the exact same thing that would happen to me. But I don't even think about it.
Yeah. And Duane, I really recommend you get into the book. There's a page, it's on page 88, and it's right when they get down about how we remind ourselves we're no longer running the show.
Yeah.
And whether it doesn't, you know, because I am egotistical enough to think that I can understand God. I absolutely. And then I'll convince. And then not only am I egotistical enough to think I'm smart enough to understand him, then I can talk myself out of him. So I can relate to that. Okay. But it doesn't matter. My job isn't a Rubik's Cube God. It's just to know that I'm not God. And then I can just put a period at the end of that. And then it says on page 88, it says we constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. And then we're in much less fear or danger of excitement, of fear, of anger, of worry, of self-pity, and foolish decisions like drinking.
Yes.
And when I first read this, it took years, and I don't identify as dumb, but it took me years. Like, what do you mean? Danger of excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, it's the opposite of peace. My whole life is a high or a low, and my pendulum is swinging wildly.
Yep.
Serenity, this thing in this prayer that we say, God grant me serenity, you know, whoever, so-and-so, red thumbtack, grant me serenity. That's why that's there, by the way.
Yeah. For the atheist.
Yeah. That's for the atheist. So when you're in our meetings, I want you to look at that. That's for the atheist.
That's for you.
Red thumbtack. Grant me the serenity, because I danger of excitement. I'm just as dangerous when I'm excited as I am when I'm super depressed. I need peace. So this, there's some stuff in this book that is, so that would be my advice.
And Dwayne, one other bit of advice. If you haven't been, and I don't think you have been because I haven't seen you there, or maybe I did, come to the Saturday morning men's stag at Rafters.
Excuse me, being
at 8 o'clock in the morning with 100 or so men, and none of them have a hangover, and it's Saturday morning. And if you don't think that there's a higher power, you tell me how 100 men can go to that meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday and none have a hangover. It's also a great meeting. It's a meeting I got sober at. So.
Great. Okay.
I go there at 7. For parking. Just go at 7. If you're going to go at 7.
That's what he does.
Takes me an hour to get there, so I get there like a quarter of 8.
I have a question of you.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a sponsor?
Good question.
I have
yes or no answer.
Sounds like he doesn't.
Thank you, AI, for the gift of giving me. That would be us. Not right now, Nels, but I do have I'm with a therapist who's still, I have 1 or 2, you'll be fine, don't worry about it. But so I'm trying. So, no, I do not have a sponsor, but I am, just like I was before, just looking and seeing how I want to work the program.
Yeah,
seeing
how
I want to
work.
You're not going to find your, the person that actually has to find someone I can actually.
Stay open-minded.
Every sponsor has their own version of the book.
All right, everybody, let's bring it back to center. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Is there any Q&A that has to do with the panel speakers? Are we good?
We're good.
Okay, we're all ready to go home. I love this. Okay. All right, so that brings us to the close of our workshop. On behalf of District 7, I would like to thank our panel speakers for sharing their experience, strength, and hope, and to thank you, all of you, for your participation. Can we give another round of applause for our panel speakers? We hope you take something with you that will support your sobriety. If you are interested in general service or becoming more involved, please feel free to speak with one of us following the workshop and after a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers. For those who care to join, let us close with the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you, sir.
Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory for ever. Amen.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hi.
It was good.